guys. I'm T2, Romeo, India Whiskey. My name is Dick. It's time to begin this tech net, as we have for 35 and a fraction years. Let's see, 1982. Going on 35 years. Main purpose of the tech net is education. The people who are curious about wireless products, radio in general, ham radio in particular, gather here and share their knowledge. Ask each other questions. How does this antenna work? And how do we make it work better? And, well, what are the 26 different kinds of ham radio like, particularly the new digital modes? And how do I make my transmitter behave? And how do I make my receiver not get those intermods and so on? There's a zillion questions. How do I understand standing wave ratio and transmission lines? It goes on and on. We're about to find out if on this holiday weekend, if anybody is listening to ham radio as opposed to being off on vacation somewhere. Let me drop. And pretty soon we will find out that there are people that want to check in. We have somebody that checked in early. That was Steve, KD2HUC, with a rather interesting question that we'll be getting into. Radio is pretty magic stuff. How does that signal, without one single electron leaving your antenna, how does that signal propagate through the air? That's a question that has baffled me for a good fraction of a lifetime. There's no simple, easy answer to that one. It's a wave. Okay. The fact that you've given it a name doesn't mean you know what the heck it is. So this wave, this electromagnetic wave, travels through space, but it doesn't consist of any electrons. I think it consists primarily of a magnetic wave, but that's just my opinion. We're going to take check-ins at this time for people who do have a question or a comment for the net. Let me drop. And try to remember to wait for the four beeps before you make a transmission. An awful lot of people get pretty excited, squeeze the mic right away, and sometimes get timed out. So wait for the four beeps, and then if you do have a question or a comment, give us your check-in at this time, your call letters and your name. Need not check-in because you're listening. After 34 and a fraction years, going on 35 years, we believe somebody is listening. And sometimes people are listening from long distances by way of Echolink and IRLP, and they're very welcome to check-in. So, if you've got a question or a comment, please check-in at this time. K2RIW listening.
Hey, E2J.
Yes. Okay, KE2EJ, you're recognized. Some mysterious person. Probably named Eric. Okay, so we got Eric. I've already signed in Steve, KD2HUC. Anyone else who's got a question or a comment? Please give me your call letters right now. K2RIW listening.
And to extend, did you get my email about the lacking amplifier?
I tell you most.
SHO, John, Los Alamos. I can always come up with something.
Okay, I heard SHO. Please give me your prefix and your name, sir. K2RIW.
Kilo Charlie 2, Sierra Hotel Oscar, John in Los Alamos.
Okay, John in Los Alamos. And into FDJ, was that? No. Wes is asking me the question, did I get his email? I certainly got the email on auto amperes and nano amperes. And I think there's another email you're referring to. Back to you, Wes.
I'm sorry. Yep. Lacking amplifier. That's the interesting video that I have sent you and Dr. Roy.
Okay. Right now you called it blocking amplifier. BLOCKING is what it sounded like. Is that what you
said? Lacking amplifier. Lacking. LL.
Okay. Lock-in amplifier is what I think you're talking about. And yes, they are kind of interesting. And if you like, we'll discuss that.
We don't like you.
If you like, we'll discuss lock-in amplifiers, which is something that's quite often used in the instrumentation world for people who are doing a certain kind of weak signal in the noise research, sinusoidal-like signals. So far, we've got Steve, Eric, John, and Wes checked in. Anyone else to check into the TechNet, please give me your call letters and name right now. K2RIW listening.
To Ann Paul. Good evening, Dick. Where's the space report?
And quite possibly that's going to be space report number 266 of the series. One last call. Anyone else to check into the TechNet, because you do have a question or a comment, please give me your call letters and name right now. K2RIW. I guess lots of people are away on vacation. Let's see if we've got Steve on frequency. Steve, KD2HUC, are you aboard at this time? K2RIW listening. Okay, maybe Steve hasn't signed in yet. Eric, sounds like you've got a subject we'd like to do.
KD2HUC, Vicky, you got a copy on me now?
Yes, I do, Steve. At first I did not. So glad you're listening. And should I repeat your question, or would you like to word it yourself? KD2HUC, K2RIW.
By all means, you can take it and share it with the net. You know, basically, the chart that I sent you. First, I want to know if you think it's accurate, and then you know, how it relates to a fan dipole. So with that, I'll give it to you, KD2HUC. Back to net.
If you Google the word dipole impedance versus altitude, or dipole impedance versus length, one of the many responses you get is a whole bunch of pictures of graphs of the impedance of a dipole versus those parameters. Let's talk about the main one that Steve's asking about, dipole versus altitude. When you plot the dipole versus altitude impedance, it starts off as a very wiggly curve at low altitudes. As you get up to very high altitudes, the wiggle gets smaller and smaller and eventually settles down to 73 ohms. So a dipole in free space has an impedance of 73 ohms as a resistor when it's the right length. But when that dipole is close to the ground, the impedance is much, much lower. There is a magic altitude at a little bit more than a quarter wavelength high where the impedance hits a peak a little bit below 100 ohms. So at very low altitudes, it's a very low impedance. Only a few ohms. At a high altitude of a little more than a quarter wave, a high year altitude, it goes up to near 100, and then wiggles back and forth to much lower, to a smaller amount of deviation as you go to higher altitudes. What's happening in that case, let me drop, is that your eye sees that ground under the dipole as a bunch of dirt and lawn and weeds and whatever. To a radio wave, the dipole, the ground looks almost like a mirror, but it's a slightly transparent mirror. The signal does penetrate into the ground a little bit when the dipole or when the antenna is directly above the ground. When it comes to long-range propagation, the signal coming out of your antenna that goes toward the horizon, and therefore it's striking the ground at a grazing angle, under those conditions, the ground is nearly a perfect reflector. Very similar to what happens when you stand in front of a store window and you're looking at the glass, and you're looking straight through the glass, you see the objects behind the glass, and if you look very carefully, you see a little bit of reflection off the glass. When you look at the glass at a grazing angle, a very shallow angle, the glass becomes much closer to being a mirror. It's much more like the Earth behaves that way to a radio wave. So, that signal that's directly below your dipole is seeing that slightly transparent mirror called Earth. A signal is primarily reversed in phase when it hits the short circuit of the Earth. It's almost reversed in phase, 180 degrees, and then reflects back up and hits the dipole. As such, the dipole is seeing a reflected signal at some particular phase angle. The amplitude of that reflection changes, and the phase angle changes as you change the altitude of the dipole. That's the origin of this impedance change. Let me drop. Now, the particular curve that Steve brought to our attention states that it's plotting the resistive component as a function of altitude. It says radiation, it just says resistance in ohms, radiation resistance in ohms. You could say that that's the resistive component, not the total impedance. If you go to the right graphs, you'll also find that the phase angle, the reactive component, also changes as a function of altitude above the ground. And those two tracks, those two curves do not track each other. The reactive component moves one way, the resistive component moves another way. The bottom line of all this is that the ground is a reflecting surface. It's going to change the impedance of your antenna. In the worst case, according to this graph, where the impedance goes as high as 100 ohms, and if you're feeding it with a 50 ohm cable without any other impedance matching technique being used, you would think that that's close to a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. When you add the reactive component, I think you can get above a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio at certain altitudes, which is not a showstopper. As long as your transmitter can tolerate a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio, 2-to-1 only represents a half a dB of loss compared to ideal. And if you're using an antenna tuner, for instance, then it becomes academic. The antenna tuner will take out that impedance mismatch and present a pure 50 ohm impedance to your transmitter, and the transmitter will crank out to full power and be happy at that particular frequency where the antenna tuner has arrived at a match. Let me drop. And your transmission line does give a slight amount of additional loss because there's a reflected signal from the mismatched dipole reflecting back and forth between the antenna and the antenna tuner. Therefore, some of the signal is bouncing back and forth in your transmission line and experiencing a little bit extra loss because it's going through the transmission line multiple times. But these, in most cases, are academic situations. Now, when you're running a fan dipole, that's one of these dipoles where you built a dipole that you want to work on 80, 40, 20, 15, and 10, for instance. So you've got half wavelength of wire at each of those lengths all coming to a common point at the center of the dipole. Let me drop. And that fan dipole becomes a very high performance kind of dipole at each one of those bands. If, for instance, you're talking about the 80 meter portion of that dipole, which, if you're not using any loading coil, is around 132 feet long at a 14 gauge wire, we'll say. When you feed that at 40 meters, 7 megacycles instead of 3.7 megacycles, the 80 meter portion is now not a half wavelength long, but it's full wavelength long. A full wavelength long dipole has an impedance of around 2,000 ohms instead of 70 ohms. Since the 40 meter dipole is there presenting 70 ohms, Your feed line sees a 70 ohm impedance from the 40 meter dipole in parallel with a 2,000 ohm impedance from the 80 meter dipole. The 80 meter dipole is such a high impedance that very small fraction of the energy goes there. Almost all of it goes to the 40 meter dipole in that example when you run 40 meters. So as you can see, a fan dipole is an automatic switching network. The radio wave will choose the portion of the antenna that presents the right impedance. The majority of the energy goes down that antenna and rejects all of the others because they are so impedance mismatched. Let me drop. So what I just said works very nicely for any fan dipole in free space. Now you put a fan dipole above your particular Earth. Your particular fan dipole might be a third of a wavelength high at 80 meters. It's going to be two-thirds of a wavelength high at 40 meters, and so on. So therefore, the reflection coefficient you get from the dipole into the ground and back sees different number of wavelengths of reflection on the various bands. Therefore, each of those bands have a slight shift in their impedance and their resonant frequency because of the ground reflection. Let me drop. A guy who is a real scientist and worrying about perfectly feeding his fan dipole gets into those details. 98% of the guys who build a fan dipole build it mechanically. The particular constraints they've got on their properties, they've got trees at a certain altitude, and they've got a tower at a certain altitude, and they mount the antenna at a convenient altitude, as high as they can get it without going into heroic efforts, and don't worry about all these fine details. From their point of view, the antenna tuner takes out all of those mismatches on all of those individual bands. However, you could, if you want to, make the antenna perfect on every one of those bands. If you really know the characteristics of your particular soil, in other words, you know its resistivity, its reactivity, and so on, if you could use the right computer modeling program for your particular soil. There's various ways you can do that. And you know how many feet above the ground or how many meters above the ground you're mounting this antenna. Let me drop. With the right computer modeling program, you could predict ahead of time exactly what impedance you're going to get on every one of those bands with that fan dipole mounted above that particular piece of soil at that particular altitude. That's all predictable. Or, conversely, you could actually go and measure it. With a good antenna analyzer, you could measure the characteristics of every one of your fan dipole elements at that particular altitude on your particular soil. So by various means, you can model it, measure it, and so on. You can find out what the exact impedance is. Once you know that exact impedance, if you have this other secret piece of information that I have been telling you guys for lots of years, which is not published in any book that I know of, and you can get a hint about this by going to amateurradio.tangovictor and look at the articles by K2RIW, or you can also go to limontechnet.com and go to those articles by that are on the websites now of Steve, of Mike number one and Mike number two. You can go to those submitted articles, and you will find out that the article by K2RIW, which is backed up by two graphs, a resistive graph and a reactive graph, that were done in 1945 by a very exact pair of guys named Brown and Woodward. Mr. Brown and Mr. Woodward, in 1945, decided to choose every possible diameter of a ground plane antenna. I think they did it at VHF frequencies. Let me drop it. Every possible length and every possible diameter of a monopole. And a monopole is half of a dipole. A dipole is a pair of monopole antennas back to back. So they measured monopoles at every reasonable length and every reasonable diameter using a signal generator, a frequency meter, a slotted line, a good slide rule, and a whole lot of calculations. They spent close to a man year measuring all of that data. And this is not model data. This is not theoretically derived data. This is real measured data. Those Brown and Woodward curves arguably are the most valuable pieces of information that are in Chapter 4 of every issue of the Antenna Engineering Handbook. I'm amazed how many people have not discovered those curves. But by way of the article, the words I said about it, and looking at those curves, and those curves are also in those two sites, Mike 1 and Mike number 2, you recognize there's something very interesting about monopoles and dipoles versus diameter and length. Let me drop. By looking at those curves, you soon realize that changing the length of the dipole in wavelength allows you to adjust the resistive component of your dipole anywhere from 1 ohm to thousands of ohms inclusive. If you wanted your dipole to have a resistive component of 997 ohms, for instance, by way of the Brown and Woodward curve, it'll tell you exactly what length of dipole will give you that exact resistive component. You can make it match exactly by adjusting nothing but the length. 99% of the time, when you find that particular length that gives you the resistive component you desire, there's always a reactive component left over. And that reactive component left over, by looking at the other curve for that particular length and that diameter of a monopole or dipole, scares the daylights out of people. You don't have to be scared about the reactive component. If your antenna was made a little bit longer than quarter wavelength, the reactive component will be inductive. Longer than quarter wavelength, the dipole is inductive. Shorter than quarter wavelength, it's capacitive. And the curves tell you exactly how much. Once you know that your dipole is inductive, because you've made it a little bit longer, to make it a 99-ohm impedance, resistive component, all you need do is put a capacitor across the driven the two terminals of the drive point of your dipole, and you will exactly control, cancel out the reactive component. There's a slight catch to that. If you put the right size capacitor in series with the dipole, in one step, you would get a perfect match with that setup. By putting the capacitor across the two terminals, not in series, to put it in series is mechanically more difficult. Get the pain in the neck. To put the capacitor in parallel across the two elements, the two feed points of the dipole, it's
repeater, timeout.
putting the... Let me drop. Putting the capacitor in parallel does the exact same kind of reactance control. In other words, if your dipole is inductive and you put a capacitor across the feed points, you're primarily controlling the reactance, making it go to near zero. Doing it in parallel is mechanically much more easy. The slight catch is, when you put a capacitor in parallel across the element, it does a minor modification of the resistive component. Therefore, you have to readjust the length again to the resistive component to come back to where you want it. That's a fancy way of saying there's an interaction between a reactor at the feed point to control reactance and the length to control the resistance. There's a little bit of feedback between the two. But after two or three steps, you'll arrive at that answer in 60 seconds, so don't worry about it. So take the easy approach. The bottom line of all this, let me drop it, is that once you know ahead of time, by way of your antenna analyzer, your network analyzer, the standing wave ratio bridge, or whatever, you'll soon find out that no matter where your dipole is located, if it's a dipole, it's part of a fan network of antenna, a fan dipole network. If your dipole is the driven element inside of a Yagi antenna, if your dipole is part of a, your dipole or monopole is part of a phased array where you put a whole bunch of monopoles in the backyard and you're feeding them at various phase angles in order to control the direction of transmission and reception. No matter where your dipole or monopole-like antenna is mounted, the environment will change its impedance in a predictable manner. But by you doing nothing but adjusting the length of the dipole and putting the right kind of a variable capacitor or variable inductor across the feed point, you can make your dipole a perfect impedance match at your favorite frequency on every place where you put that dipole. That's one way of looking at it. Let me drop it. Another way of looking at this whole situation is that there, what I'm doing is you're adjusting the length and the reactance you put across the feed point to make it a perfect match, 50 ohms if that's what you desire, 70 ohms, 90 ohms, whatever, for your particular transmission line, 300 ohms, 600 ohms if it's open wire line. You can make your dipole whatever impedance you desire. Anything from 1 ohm to 2,000 ohms resistive, inclusive, and any amount of reactance from 2,000 ohms negative, meaning capacitive, to 2,000 ohms positive, meaning inductive. You can make your dipole, no matter where it starts off in impedance, you can make it perfect. Or conversely, you can make your dipole any impedance you desire. If for some crazy reason, because of the way your particular feed network works, you want your dipole to look like 121 ohms resistive and 31 ohms capacitive. If that's your favorite impedance you want your dipole to present, by way of you adjusting length and reactor you put across the feed terminals, or by doing it theoretically, if you like, by looking at the Brown and Woodward curves, or whatever the means you like, you can make your dipole any impedance resistive, any impedance reactive that you desire by doing nothing but adjusting length and changing the reactor you put across the feed point. That's an extremely well-kept secret. I know of no book that says those words. I own about 30 or 40 books on antennas. I've been living in the world of antennas for the last 40 years as an occupation and as a consultant. And so I know of no book that says those words. Whatever impedance you think is desirable, by doing nothing but adjusting length and a reactor across the feed point, you can make your dipole any impedance.
Repeater, timeout.
You can make your dipole any impedance you desire. There's lots and lots of articles about people who want to change the impedance of a dipole, and they use a whole lot of mechanical means to do it. Using a delta match, using a gamma match, using a folded dipole match, using a multi-wire folded dipole match, gamma match, T-match, and so on. All kinds of mechanical structures people have put on their dipole in order to make it a certain impedance that they desire. They thought you can only control the impedance by using mechanical doodads on the dipole, changing the diameter of the dipole versus the diameter of the wire that's part of the folded dipole, and so on. All all kinds of mechanical techniques have been used to control impedance. Do that if you like, but you didn't have to do that. Whatever your favorite method of construction of the dipole is, for good, strong mechanical reasons, go and do it. Then after that, you can make the impedance of the dipole anything you desire. From 1 ohms to 2,000 ohms resistive, from minus 2,000 ohms to plus 2,000 ohms reactive, and any combination in between, by doing nothing but adjusting length and the reactor you put across the feed point. A couple of smart companies that build antennas as an occupation have discovered that, and they've kept it close to their chest. It has not been published in any article I know about. It is not in any book that I know about. You guys got that secret piece of information. The world of impedance matching your particular antenna to make it perfect impedance match, or whatever you like, at your favorite frequency, is extremely easy to do once you accept this concept. At first, it doesn't make sense until you start digging into the particulars of those Brown and Woodward curves. Let me drop. Mr. Brown and Mr. Woodward, working for, I think, Bell Laboratories, roughly in 1945, realized that a bunch of people had done a bunch of theoretical studies as to what they thought the impedance of a dipole should be as a function of length, diameter, folding, and whatever. And all of these formulas gave medium quality results near quarter wave resonance of the dipole. But if you got away from quarter wave resonance, all of those prediction formulas and methods of analysis fell down and didn't work. There's something very complicated going on with RF energy flowing down that dipole if it's not a quarter wavelength long. So rather than worrying about how to derive formulas that calculated it ahead of time, they said, hey, this is complicated. They went and measured it. And each of those curves is a family of curves for various diameters and various lengths, and that's real measured data that you and I could go and duplicate, and you're going to get those exact results. As I said, they spent about a man year measuring all of that data. Nowadays, with a modern vector network analyzer, you could do that all in a fraction of a day, as long as you had the right mechanical stuff ready to roll for the test, if you know what I mean. So very valuable data. I'm amazed how many skilled antenna engineers with 20 and 30 years of experience have not yet discovered Chapter 4 of the Antenna Engineering Handbook. Let me drop this. Whenever I'm in an IEEE meeting from the Antennas and Propagation Society, or the Microwave Theory and Technique Society, and I say some of these words, and I say all the data to do that is in Chapter 4 of the Antenna Engineering Handbook, a number of these seasoned antenna engineers in the audience will say, what chapter was that? And I say to myself, what rock have you guys been living under? At first, that was my response. I suddenly realized that it's not their fault. They are victims. They've been victimized by the way that we teach the science of antenna engineering in the United States. We could be teaching it by ways that are much better. So, I wonder if this is some of the information you're looking for, Steve. KD2HUC, you could make it perfect at any one of those bands simultaneously by adjusting the dipole length of your fan dipole on that particular band, experimentally, theoretically, all kinds of ways you could do it. If you want to be that much of a scientist and if you want to make it perfect at your favorite frequency on each one of those bands. 82HUC, Steve, the guy who asked this question, you got it, Steve. K2IW and the TechNet. Darn good question.
Okay, let me try to process some of this data. All right, so the first thing is, if you can adjust the length and then adjust the reactive component by placing the capacitor. Now, you said placing the capacitor across the feed point is mechanically easier. But how would you do that with a fan dipole when now you're going to be, I'm assuming, having to place capacitors of different values across that feed point for the different bands? I mean, outside of some sort of external switching network, I doubt there would be a one-size-fit-all. Let me let it drop.
Stop right there, Steve. You hit the nail on the head. Let me drop. Yeah, give that man a cigar. I was much too fast when I said putting the capacitor across the feed point. In the case of a fan dipole, if you need a 10 picofarad capacitor for 80 meters and a 20 picofarad capacitor for 40 meters, Without a switching network, you can't do that. So in that particular case, if you want your fan dipole to be perfect in every one of the bands, yes, you're now going to step back, and you're going to put the variable capacitors, the reactor, in series with the dipole. You're going to do it in one step. So if you've got the right capacitor in series with the 80-meter dipole, and the right capacitor in series with the 40-meter dipole, and now, and so on, you can now make every one of your bands a perfect match on your particular fan dipole. And there's one step beyond this one, Steve. Let me go one step further here. If the fan dipole really took my original statement where the energy flows down the right dipole, and if that was the only place the energy flowed, in other words, when you're on 40 meters, the 40-meter dipole is presenting a 73-ohm impedance, the 80-meter dipole is presenting a 2,000-ohm impedance, very little energy flows down the 80-meter dipole. Let me drop. And the 20-meter dipole is presenting a capacitance, and the 10-meter dipole is presenting a capacitance. So the composite impedance of your fan dipole, even if you've now made each individual dipole perfect by putting the right series capacitor, so to speak, in series with that particular dipole, you've made each dipole perfect. Because the other dipoles are present, and they're making a small amount of perturbation, they're presenting a small amount of capacitive or inductive reactance, the fan dipole composite impedance is now a little bit more complicated. And so, is there now a way of adjusting those capacitors on those individual dipoles to make it all perfect on every band simultaneously? That's a little bit more difficult. Doable, as a calculation, it's pretty tough. With a good antenna tuner, the problem goes away, but you can see that the unused dipole in your fan dipole, they're only presenting a minor perturbation, but there's four of them at each instant of time, and therefore they're going to give you some effect, like a 1.3 Viswire when you think you're going to get a 1.1. And you were starting to sense that, Steve, and you're right on. KD2HUC, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay. Let me give you some background on this, because this is not just an academic question. The issue that I have is I have a fan dipole that's up in the air, obviously, and I have about 200 feet of feed line between the feed point of that antenna and the shack. So having a tuner in the shack really doesn't do all that much, because I'm still suffering the loss of the reflections in the feed line, you know, for 200 feet. So the only thing I can do, let me let it drop, is either spend a lot of money on a remote tuner, which I don't want to do, or solve this problem. So I want to see what's involved in solving this problem. Let me let it drop. From the chart that I sent you, it would appear that a normal, that you could have a dipole present a 50-ohm resistive component, and assuming it's properly linked, you know, properly sized for the frequency, it should have a zero reactive component, so about 3/16 of a wavelength above the Earth. Does that sound about right? I mean, is that graph accurate? KD2HUC, back to net.
Yeah, various versions of that graph appear in many respected sites. That graph is accurate for a particular kind of soil. Now, is the soil in your particular backyard that exact soil? Of course not. It may be close. But for a particular class of soil, you're going to get exactly that curve. And if you really went to the one of the better ways of drawing that curve, where if you made a more complicated graph where the horizontal axis is the resistive component and the vertical axis is the reactive component, a Smith chart, for instance, you will find out as a function of altitude, your impedance of your antenna traces out a spiral. And the spiral slowly settles into the center of the Smith chart at high altitude if it's a 73-ohm Smith chart, if you know what I mean. So the real total impedance, the reactive component and the resistive component, properly plotted, is a spiral as a function of altitude, or it's also a spiral as a function of length, or a spiral as a function of frequency, if you know what I mean. Slightly different spirals, but it's all very predictable. In the worst case, if your fan dipole on the worst frequencies presented a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio with your 200 feet of transmission line. Let me drop. A 2-to-1 standing wave ratio, if that's the worst you're going to get, and maybe it is only a half a dB of extra loss because of reflected energy. 2-to-1 standing wave ratio is 0.5 dB of loss, which is 1/12 of an S unit. I wouldn't lose a whole lot of sleep over that. If you did lose a whole lot of sleep over that, you could always use a fatter transmission line. The lowest loss transmission line in the world is open wire line, although that's another impedance matching problem when it comes to a fan dipole. You now have to use some kind of a broadband balun at the far end, which is not too expensive. A hell of a lot cheaper than a remotely tuned antenna tuner. So, in your particular case, if on your study you find out that your antenna right at its feed point is a worst case 2-to-1 standing wave ratio, and 2-to-1 never gives you more than half a dB of loss, that, in my opinion, would not justify you spending all the big bucks for a remote antenna tuner, Steve. And even if that half a dB loss bothered you, you can always go to a fatter transmission line. You know, a hard line with foam center, which has got very low loss, if you can tolerate the weight. KD2HUC, K2LIW in the TechNet. You got it, Steve.
Yeah, I agree with you, Dick. But now the issue that I'm presented with is, for example, and the reason I asked the question, I have this fan dipole. At 40 meters, I'm just about 3/16 above the ground. Very close impedance match. Probably 2-to-1 SWR. Things are working great. Now I switch the band to 80 meters, and I'm seeing 6-to-1, 10-to-1, and so on and so forth. You know, 20 meters is not as bad, but this is what I'm looking at, and I'm trying to figure out how to impedance match this thing. And so that's why I, let me let it drop. That's why I asked a question regarding the height, because I have a fan dipole that's, you know, relatively mounted at the right height for a 40 meter to give me a close impedance match. However, it's not playing nice on the other bands. So now I have to come up with some means of tuning it without getting involved in a remote tuner. And if I do a correction, like you said, I'll have to put the capacitors, I guess, in series with the elements. Which now brings me to the next question. Do you divide the capacitance over both halves, or is a capacitor in a single side of the dipole sufficient? KD2HUC, back to net.
Okay, let's first discuss drastic altitude on 80 meters. That curve shows me that the resistive component goes down to 30 ohms at roughly an eighth of a wavelength. As you start getting to an eighth of a wavelength of altitude or lower, the resistive component starts going to zero real fast. So as long as you're at least an eighth of a wavelength above the ground, eighth of a wavelength on 80 meters, I think is 30 feet. Let me take that. Half wave is 130, quarter wave is 60, eighth wave is 30 some odd feet. As long as your fan dipole is 30 some odd feet above the ground, you're at least in an eighth of a wavelength. The resistor component is 30 ohms or higher, and that's less than a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. If you're trying to mount your fan dipole 10 feet off the ground, I'll admit that 80 meters is going to give you a lot of grief in standing wave ratio. However, the standing wave ratio on 80 meters is correctable, as we discussed, by way of the impedance matching techniques. Adjusting length and a reactor, you can make it perfect, even at your particular altitude. The only other thing you're going to worry about now is that when the dipole is only an eighth of a wavelength above the ground on 80 meters, it is a near vertical incident sky wave antenna. In other words, it's because of ground reflection, and the ground so nearby. Let me drop. Because of that mechanical layout, you're launching the signal straight up in the air. A much smaller portion of it is going out toward the horizon. So a NEVIS antenna, near vertical incident sky wave antenna, is great for short range QSOs. Having a QSO with a guy in New Jersey when you're on Long Island. But about 80 meters, you want to talk to a guy in a much longer distance, a NEVIS antenna is not necessarily the right way to go. So even at 30 feet above the ground, It's not drastic yet as I see it, Steve. And now, when it comes to the reactor you're going to put on the antenna, the capacitor in series, do you put half of it on each side? In the ideal world, yes. However, how are you feeding your fan dipole? If your fan dipole is being fed with a broadband balun right at the feed point of the antenna, at the end of the transmission line, you have the complete freedom of putting the reactor on one side. The balun takes care of the fact that there's an imbalance in the dipole itself. Reactor on only one half of the dipole. Let me drop it. However, if your coax cable is going straight to the dipole, shield goes to one half of your fan dipole, and a set of conductor goes to the other half. Now, you think you've got a dipole antenna. You've really got a tripole antenna. Because, by definition, some of that signal you're trying to launch into the fan dipole is now appearing on the outside of the coax cable, and the coax cable is now another radiator. And it's going to be very different on the amount of radiation depending on how many wavelengths long is the transmission line, what band you're on, and so on. There's a whole lot of variables there. And if you're now feeding with the coax cable going straight to the fan dipole, is there a desirable place to put the reactor in series with the dipole? Should it be on the side that goes to the center conductor as opposed to the side that goes to the shield? I think the answer is yes. I'm pretty sure the answer is yes, but I'm not positive. So there's a bunch of other complicated things going on if your transmission line is going straight to the dipole without a balancing structure. Your dipole is really a tripole. I wonder how you're feeding it, Steve. If I know you, you've got a broadband balun right at the antenna, a one-to-one. KD2HUC, K2IW in the TechNet.
Yes, sir, Dick. A one-to-one balun is at the center point of the dipole. KD2HUC, back to that.
Which means you now have the freedom of putting your reactor that's correcting the impedance of the dipole only on one side. You don't have to make it balanced because the balun takes care of any imbalance. So my guess is your fan dipole is more than 30 feet in the air. That means it's more than an eighth wavelength on 80 meters above. Therefore, your 30 ohms are above on the resistive component according to your chart for that particular kind of soil that they plotted that for. Therefore, you're pretty much under a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. And a 2-to-1 never gives you more than half a dB of loss, of extra loss, because of this loss, regardless of what feed line you're using and how much loss it has. Only an extra half a dB because of the VISWA. You might be a hell of a lot better off than you thought. This curve led you to believe that your 200 feet of cable is giving you all kinds of grief. I think it is not. I wonder if you're beginning to agree with me, Steve. KD2HUC, K2IW in the TechNet.
Yeah, I think that as a result of this conversation, it looks like I'm going in the wrong direction. Because if you're saying that I should have a 2-to-1 VISWAR, that's not what the SWR meter's telling me. So that would lead me to believe that maybe something else is wrong. So I guess I know how I'll be spending my Labor Day holiday, finding out where this other problem may be. Dick, I appreciate all the time. I don't want to clog up the entire net, but thank you very much for the information. KD2HUC, back to net.
Dick, remind him, if it ain't broke, don't try to fix it.
Okay, Charlie. Steve, you gave us a hint. On some of your bands, you're getting a high VISWAR. I guess 80 meters is one of those bands. Tell me roughly what VISWAR you see on each one of the bands with your fan dipole. And is your fan dipole roughly 30 feet in the air, Steve? KD2HUC for those, K2IW the TechNet.
It's an inverted V, Dick. The center point is, about 30 feet up in the air. The ends come down to, I don't know, maybe about between 15 and 20 feet at each end. And I've seen VISWARs as high as 15 to 1 on 80 meters. So it's, I'm definitely seeing something that's off. And, as I've been doing my research, I find this graph about height, and now all of a sudden I'm wondering about how you would do a dipole when it's all at one height. KD2HUC, back to net.
Okay, 200 feet of transmission line. What kind of transmission line is that? Is that something like RG8? Steve, go ahead. RG-213, Dick. Which is the mil-spec version of RG-8. Good stuff. Okay. And 80 meters, it has so little insertion loss that therefore you could see a standing wave ratio as high as 15 to 1. 15 to 1. Yeah, that is high. But yours is not a pure 30-foot high fan dipole. It's really an inverted V fan dipole. Much more complicated structure. And the fact that the tips of that dipole are like 15 feet off the ground means that your average altitude off the ground is closer to a 16th of a wavelength, which on the far left-hand side of that chart, where it's going down real fast, that sort of figures. So it sounds like the resistive component is getting kind of low. And according to the Brown and Woodward curves, you can make the resistive component go as high as you like by making the dipole longer. In your particular case, where it's an inverted V, as you make the dipole longer, the tips are going to get closer to the ground. It's not a simple solution in your particular case. So, Now, the Brown and Woodward curves tell you that a longer dipole gives you higher impedance. But the longer dipole really means electronically longer. It doesn't necessarily have to be physically longer. The possibility exists that the right kind of a loading inductor on the feed point would correct things. If you have ways of getting a hold of anything that can measure phase angle of the reflected signal, an antenna analyzer, a vector network analyzer, or whatever, even a trombone, well, 80 meters, a trombone, let me drop it. By one means or another, you can find out what are the components of your 15 to 1 standing wave ratio on 80 meters. If you knew by whatever means that 15 to 1 standing wave ratio was, let me pick a number out of the air, maybe it's an 85% voltage reflection characteristic. So 85% of your voltage going to the dipole is being reflected, in my example. Maybe that's a 15 to 1. And if you knew the phase angle of the reflection measured in the shack, and you know your transmission line is 200 feet long, with some not too complicated mathematics and or Smith chart, you can find out what is the exact impedance at the antenna as if your antenna analyzer was at the antenna. Once you know what is the impedance of the antenna, maybe it is 200 ohms of inductive reactance, so to speak, or 200 ohms of capacitive reactance. So if you know the exact impedance of your antenna at 80 meters, then it gives you a lot more hint as to what to do to correct it. I don't think you've got an error. I think your measurement is real. It's because your unusual arrangement of inverted V with the tip so close to the ground are giving you this characteristic. Do you have any way of getting a hold of an antenna analyzer and any other thing that can measure real impedance of the antenna measured in the shack or phase angle of the signal reflected back to the shack? Do you have ways of getting your hands on something that can make that measurement by which you can find out what is the real impedance of the antenna at 80 meters? That will tell you what to do next. KD2HUC, it's still a good question. Don't worry about it. K2RIW, you got it, Steve.
Yeah, I think I could get my hands on an antenna analyzer. I guess that would kind of be the next step. I mean, other than that, the only other thing I think I could do is probably go out to where lower the feed point and put a dummy load there and see if I get a one-to-one with the dummy load. Maybe I have a bad connection or something. Maybe I got water in the connection, even though everything is sealed up tight. But now, how big of an inductor are we thinking about here, Dick? Is something small, like a couple of turns of wire, or are we talking about, a real winding? KD2HUC, back to that.
The correction might only be a couple of turns. And is it going to be in series or power? We'll find out about that. Now, you're worried about something being very lossy going out there. However, you're not measuring a high standing wave ratio on the other band, only on 80 meters. That tells me your transmission line is working. Your balun, if your balun was rated for 40 meters and above, a one-to-one balun, and you're using it on 80 meters, that could give you some weird effects. I'm assuming you're using a one-to-one balun which has a known good rating at 80 meters. So the slim possibility exists the balun is giving you a funny effect. And so putting a dummy load on the far end of the balun the 50-ohm dummy load in the far end of the ballot and re-measuring it on 80 meters. That could give you a lot of information right there. Is the ballot doing something funny? I'm assuming your ballot is rated down to 80 meters. Is that true, Steve? Go ahead.
Well, the rating is 1.6 to 30 megs.
Out of curiosity, what brand name, what model number of ballon are you using, Steve?
Give me 1 second and I can provide you that information.
As you make these measurements over the holiday weekend, by putting a dummy load there, getting a holding of an antenna tuner, and the antenna tuner is going to tell you what you measure in the shack. And now 200 ohms, 200 feet of transmission line with a known velocity factor. There's various ways that you can now box that out on the Smith chart, so to speak, to find out what is the real impedance right at the feed point of the ballon, right at the antenna. So there's ways of taking out the 200 feet of transmission line, which, by the way, is some 3/4 of a wavelength at an 80 meters, so to speak. So there's ways of cranking that back out, as if the antenna tuner was used right at the antenna. When you make these measurements and you start getting these results, please come back and tell us what you find. There's going to be various people who are interested in this detective story that you're involved with, Steve. KD2HUC, K2RIW in the TechNet.
All right, Dick, I'll definitely do that. The Ballon is an MFJ-918. That's the model number. It's a one-to-one, and it's 1.82, 30 megahertz, and it's rated up to legal limit. Like I said, I appreciate all the help, and I will definitely come back, because I might need a hand sorting out all this stuff. As always, I appreciate it, Dick. KD2HUC, back to net.
That's a good question, Steve. Thank you. Somebody has a comment. Whoever it was talked first and squeezed late, so I only heard the... I didn't even hear the word comment. I heard ent. Who was that? Give me your call letters and name, K2RIW.
GJE.
Okay, again, I heard only GJE. But give me the whole prefix, call letters, and name. Go right ahead, sir. I know you've checked in before. I should know you.
K2GJE, over.
K2GJE, over. Start up your name and go right ahead with your comment, sir.
Good evening, Dick. How about the old-fashioned brute force method, sweep above and below the frequency he wants to operate on, and look at the SWR. It'll tell him if that wire should be shorter, over.
Okay, Ed. You really didn't want to tell me your name, so I had to look it up. If it was nothing but the wrong length of antenna, at a good high altitude, sweeping up and down in frequency where you're eventually going to get a bathtub-shaped curve when you plot standing wave ratio versus frequency, and the bottom of the bathtub tells you where the antenna is resonant. For a simple dipole at a high altitude, that's a good thing to do. He has a more complicated case. Because he's got a inverted V where the tips of the dipole are coming much closer to the ground, so he's getting capacitive loading at the end. He's also, for all we know, he's got the trees nearby with a lot of sap in them this time of year, which are giving him another capacitive loading. Maybe one end is coming near the downspouts and the wiring of the house. There's a whole lot of other things going on. It's worth a try, sweeping standing wave ratio versus frequency. In the case of 80 meters, he can sweep it from 3.5 to 4.0. It'll give him some more information, but it may not be a nice, simple, bathtub-shaped curve telling him it's the wrong length. There's more going on here. It's worth a try. It doesn't take a whole lot of time to do it, so I agree with you, Ed. You should do that. But he may not get a simple answer for the reasons I just gave. See what I just said, Ed? KD2GJE, K2RIW.
Heard you loud and clear. I know it's a complex antenna that he has there, but it seems to be very happy on the other bands. It's certainly worth a quick try. Over.
Yes, it is, Ed. but on the other bands, that exact same dipole on the other bands is much higher above the ground in wavelength for two reasons. One, the higher frequencies, the wavelengths are shorter, and 30 feet above the ground is a larger number of wavelengths. Second of all, because it's a fan dipole as an inverted V, the higher band dipoles are shorter, therefore the tips don't come down as close to the ground. He's got a complicated antenna. So the fact that the higher bands work well is necessary but not sufficient of explaining what's going on. So, as he makes those measurements, as he does his antenna analyzer approach and whatever, we're going to find out what's going on. It's a good detective story. And soon, Steve will give us more information. And thank you for your comments, Ed. Next person on our list was some guy named Eric, KE2EJ, a broadcast engineer. You're supposed to have all the answers. Why in the world would you have a question for us, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RIW, and the TechNet.
K2RIW, KE2EJ. Actually, I've got three questions, but the first one is, did you ever reach anybody about those microwave radios?
I haven't yet had a reply, but hang in there. Go ahead, Eric, on the next two questions.
All right, this is about, actually this is a single stage amplifier, and operating it at, say, let's say the 1 dB compression point. Now, what I'm trying to do is, I wrote a program which actually, what I'm looking for, the small signal nonlinearity, right? And the basis of this actually works with Pascal's triangle. You're familiar with that?
Yes, I think I am. Go ahead.
Alright, the math that I'm creating only goes out to the third order intermodulation products, right? So, keeping it simple. And basically, we're talking about voltage in, voltage out. And we're applying the angular theorem to it. So basically we're talking about voltage times the sine of omega of 1 plus the sine of omega of 2 and so on to 3. Now, I don't know if I've got this right, but when it comes to looking at the intermodulation products, let me drop. I don't know if this is right, if I got it right, okay? When I look at the individual components, right, it always seems that the second order intermodulation product is 6 dB higher than the second harmonic, and the third order intermodulation products are 9 dB and change. Is this right?
With most amplifiers that saturate in a classic manner, no. Second harmonic, third harmonic, fourth harmonic, they fall off like a Christmas tree. Most of the time, when you're in the early stages of saturation, like 1 dB of compression, you start going into hard saturation, yeah, other crazy things happen, but the harmonic should fall off like a Christmas tree. But I'm going to make a guess as to which...
Not harmonic, intermodulation product from the harmonic.
They still fall off. One of your intermodulation products is a 2x1. Another one is a 3x2. Another one is a 2x3. Another one is a 4x3, and so on. As you go to the higher and higher subscripts to explain that particular intermodulation distortion product, they all fall off with the higher numbers. That's the way a real amplifier behaves. But where I'm guessing you're about to go with this, you mentioned a one-stage amplifier. You're studying one stage and eventually you're going to get to two stage. And we've done a study like that to try to explain the intermodulation distortion products we saw on the B1 bomber receiver, which had to go from CC to light, had to tolerate very strong signals. We know we were going to be getting saturation. And in our cases, we had pre-amplifiers at the antennas. After 75 feet of waveguide, we had more amplifiers inside the rest of the receiver. So we had all kinds of intermodulation distortion products happening from multiple amplifiers going into 1 dB of compression simultaneously, with various lengths of transmission line between them.